Tom Salter has worked with video game music for nearly two decades. After honing his skills on titles like Red Steel, Crackdown, the Tom Clancy series, and more, his latest OST, for Wolfenstein Youngblood, sees him reach back into the 80s for inspiration. Full of authentic sounds and approaches from the time, Tom melded them with more modern techniques into a hard-hitting retro soundtrack. He also recently contributed more to the Wolfenstein series through a specially composed suite for its VR offshoot, Cyberpilot. In this bonus episode of the Soundtest, I catch up with Tom about his music for Wolfenstein and his career in VGM as a whole. Along with his most up-to-date soundtracks, we also discuss the influence of VR on composers, racing games, and two of my old favourites from his career. I hope you enjoy this more casual bonus edition ahead of ST2 in November. And don't forget that you can catch all my future live interviews on this channel at 8 p.m. UK every Sunday. Hello, Tom. Welcome onto the Soundtest.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
It's been a while since I've done one of these live interviews, so it should be fun.
Yeah, it should be.
Wolfenstein Youngblood, if I'm not wrong, is your latest work.
That is true, yes. Youngblood and the VR prequel called Cyberpilot.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I definitely have some stuff to talk about with VR and definitely some details about, like, more about how these soundtracks were created. But at first, for people who might not know Wolfenstein so well, I wondered if you could sum up the kind of general style you was going for with Youngblood.
Yeah, so with Youngblood, it was a lot of fun. Wolfenstein definitely has a style of music for it. It's always this post-apocalyptic, dark, you know, intense, aggressive music. But in Youngblood and Cyberpilot, it was especially fun for me because we are going now to the daughters of the main character, and it takes place in 1980 Paris. So there was an opportunity there, and the audio director really wanted to fully embrace the early 1980 post-punk sound and integrate that into this style of the score. So it was especially fun for me because anyone who knows me, I'm a huge fan of the 80s and music included. So that really set the stage for some interesting and fun work.
And yeah, and because of that setting and that kind of style you were going for, I've read that you were using a lot of authentic or almost completely authentic 80s synths and samplers and effects and things like that. So I wondered if you could detail some of those that you used and what they brought to the project.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So, yes, the signal chain and the sound sources and everything was authentic 80s. Now, that being said, some of it was the actual old hardware, and then some of it was software, you know, simulations of the old hardware. But, you know, for example, let's say the Lexicon 480 Reverb, a lot of people would know that from the 80s. And so I don't have that unit, but these days you can use very accurate, licensed, approved versions of these plugins, so they're indistinguishable from the real thing. So in any case, I had a lot of fun using synth sources like Prophets and Model D, Mini Moog, and things like that. And then, you know, tons of virtual synths. And I still have a lot of my old synths from the 80s still here in my studio. The Roland Juno 106 and the JX3P, etc. But also, you know, when we hear 80s, it wasn't just a synth score. In fact, initially, it wasn't at all. Nick, the audio director, really wanted to embrace the post-punk sound of, let's say, the Cocteau Twins' Graceland's album. And pretty much there's no synths whatsoever on that. In that case, I really went for using guitar and guitar textures that were evocative of that time frame and that album specifically, because it has a certain vibe to it that works beautifully for this project. So it became this mesh of certain iconic 80s sounds. So, for example, you take that Cocteau Twins sound, and then I really wanted to bring some of the iconic early 80s synth stuff, especially when you talk about dark post-apocalyptic stuff. So let's just say you take like John Carpenter, who symbolizes, you know, early 80s synth scores, and of course, you know, like things like Vangelis Blade Runner and stuff. So as I was experimenting with these various pillars, sound recipes, as you would, that I was able to kind of make this unique fusion, which is unmistakably Wolfenstein, Youngblood. And I call it the twin blade sound, the twin for the Cocteau Twins and the blade for Blade Runner. And, it just sounds cool. And it was just like this fusion that has become now for me the sound of that game. And, of course, I also was a co-composer alongside of Martin Stig Anderson, and he worked on his own half of the score. And we can talk more about how that worked out. But anyway, that's an overview of how I approached it.
Absolutely. I'm definitely interested in how things worked with Martin. But when it came to the guitars, I was intrigued in how those put together. Like, are you a guitarist yourself? Is it your first and foremost instrument? And like, do you ever bring in session players and things like that?
No, I am not a guitarist. I wish I was. I do bring in session players, and I did initially because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't, cutting any corners, and we got an authentic sound. I brought in some really great players who were friends and colleagues of mine. But as the score evolved, certainly as a creator, it's great to be able to compose with freedom and not have to worry about booking a session. So in that sense, what I was able to do is develop some techniques using artificial or samples of guitars, real guitars, and sometimes custom synth sounds that I ran through customized distortion chains that were very much inspired by, let's say, that Cocteau Twin sound. And what it enabled me to do is create this guitar-esque texture, this sound, this patch, which shows up all over the score, and it's actually not a guitar. So any guitarist that's listening to this is going to be like, okay, cool, but that's not exactly a guitar, but it's sort of, it could be. I'm not sure if it is or if it's not, but, so it became something even more original sounding. It wasn't just, okay, let's just get a guitar and do the thing, and, this actually became something very new and innovative in that sense.
Right, that's really interesting. I had no idea that those kinds of things were going on. Could you talk a little bit more about how that was developed?
Yeah, well, the way it happened was I started working with plugins to kind of recreate the Cocteau Twin sound. When I was pitching on the project before I got chosen, it was definitely part of the pitch was to get that sound and create something original with that vocabulary. And so in doing so, I spent a significant amount of time experimenting with various gear, plugins, effect chains to create that certain sound. And that sound was, I describe it as like, say, a light distortion with a heavy 80s inspired chorus, 70s, 80s chorus sound, a very reverberant, and then lots of bendy, kind of dreamy kind of things, kind of, yeah, just kind of created this drugged out feeling in a way, hallucinogenic kind of sound. And so I started by putting real guitars through it, with some of my guitar friends, would come and play some stuff. And then I'd put it through that chain. But then I started getting experimental and started putting some of my guitar samples through them, undistorted guitar recordings that I have and samples that I can play myself. And I'm like, ooh, that sounds really cool. And then I went one step further and started taking synthesizer sounds and putting it through. So I started putting the like 80s sampler, let's say like Emulator 2 sounds, synth sounds. So a sampled 80s synth through an Emulator 2 going through that 80s guitar distortion chorusy chain with these Lexicon reverbs and things. So it became this really cool soup, and this unmistakable sound that I've grown to really love, and I used it throughout the entire score.
Yeah, because like despite those 80s influences, it is a very unique thing. And for me, that kind of plays into the kind of alternate history thing.
Yes, right. Yeah, this wasn't like, you know, the 80s that I was listening to growing up. I was listening to like, you know, synth wave, you know, and Depeche Mode and New Order and Yaz and things like this. So this is not the shiny, happy, bright synths. This is the antithesis of that. This was the dark, gritty, rusty, dirty, you know, apocalyptic kind of post-apocalyptic kind of 80s sound, you know. So it was cool. It brought me into a new place, a new creative sandbox, if you will.
Which kind of comes to a head at the very end for the end credits. The Gilts version of Joy Division, Means to an End, which you produced, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, yeah. That's correct. So that was a fun little story. So The Gilt is this heavy synth punk band in Sweden that the developers over at Machine Games are big fans of. And so somewhere along the project, Nick mentioned to me that they were intending to hire The Gilt to do a cover of a Joy Division track, which I had never heard before, called A Means to an End. So I took a listen to the track and I was like, wow, really? This one? Because if you listen to the original, it's really melancholic and much slower paced. So when I heard that, I was like, okay, but so why particularly this song? And Nick went on to explain that it was really because of the lyric content. It really worked well for the story of the game and the story of the sisters. So I'm like, okay, I get that. So they connected me with Emma and Tobias in Sweden, who are The Gilt, and they were great. We had a Skype session to talk and discuss it. And funny enough, they felt the same way about the track. They're like, really this? Like, because if you listen to The Gilt stuff, I mean, their stuff is very heavy, driving, fast, high energy, and this is the opposite. But it did enable me to kind of embrace a very unique take on it. So, you know, the first thing that I imagined when I wanted to create a unique cover version of this song was let's start by just upping that tempo all the way. So instead of doon 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 doon, it was like doon 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 doon, you know, it was like that. So I started by sketching the song out using 80s drum machine sounds and like a Model D Moog synthesizer, you know, kind of just to lay the framework and then kind of let them listen to that, absorb it, and then start to layer on top of it. So Emma started doing some vocal takes, and it took her a while to really own the song because it was such a big leap from where it was to what it would become. And she was wonderful working with her and Tobias. They were really great. They really embraced the collaboration process. So we went back and forth. I sent them stuff. They sent me stuff. I made some comments. They redid some things. Blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the day, we got this really great, unique, fun cover version of A Means to an End, which is featured at the end of the game in the ending credits. And you can also hear it on my SoundCloud page.
And you also mentioned working with Martin Stig Hansen, or rather you mentioned that he might have worked separately. Was there any kind of collaboration between the two of you? And if not, what were the different strengths you were bringing to the project?
Yeah, so it was clearly laid out. Nick, the audio director, had worked with Martin before on the previous Wolfenstein score. So he had a really good idea of what Martin's strengths were and what he wanted him to focus on. But we had a wonderful conversation. I mean, I wanted to speak to Martin in person. I really wanted it to be that we were coordinating what we were doing together. And we both are easygoing guys, and we really didn't have anything to prove to each other. It didn't become a competition, which sometimes can be weird when you've got multiple composers. But I really embraced it, and I was open to share whatever he wanted of mine, if he wanted to hear any of my material or stems or content that he could incorporate. So we were very transparent about what we were doing. We shared early on some of our approaches for dealing with combat. The way we used our, you know, 80s drum machine sounds. He told me some of the gear he got. He started sending me some pictures. I started sharing with him some of my sketches and things like that. So even though we were independent. We weren't collaborating on the same piece of music necessarily. We were coordinating at the same time, and it was really wonderful. I'd be very happy to do that again. It was a very good, comfortable, friendly way of working on a project. And at the end of the day, there still is that cohesiveness, even though it's, you can distinctly say, okay, this has a sound to it. It still fits in this universe. It still fits in this game. We follow the same musical recipe, so to speak, but in our own way. In our own way. So they work great.
I didn't actually look into this. I should have done, but was that an arrangement that continued on into CyberPilot as well then?
No, in the case of CyberPilot, I was brought in only to just do some additional original music. Now, I played CyberPilot. I have it on the Vive, and it's really cool. I just love being immersed in the game in three dimensions, you know, three-dimensional space. But I was brought in to do a final suite of music that is used towards the end of the game. And the rest of the music in the game, I believe they repurposed a bunch of music from Wolfenstein Youngblood. So I know I did hear some of my music from Youngblood. I have to assume that they also use some of Martin's. I don't know for sure, because I haven't played it all the way through, because I'm not that good. But they did. So there is crossover, and stylistically it was very similar. But the new music that I composed had more of a high tech element to it, because there's more about computers, hacking, robots, things like that. So they wanted to have like a slightly updated or enhanced, evolved color to that additional original music that I was doing.
Yeah, which also kind of plays into the fact that this is very new technology that you have literally sat on your head when you're playing it as well, I guess.
Well, yes. And even in the context of the game, the whole premise of the game is that you've hacked into one of those robotic dog creature robots. Well, I forgot what they call them, but so you are already much more of a computer, you know, there's much more of a computerized thing there, because it's all about, you know, you're not running around yourself with a gun. You're basically tethered to a robot, you know. So it has much more of that high tech hacking element to it.
Well, in composing that final suite for, and it's a VR game. I think we've probably made that clear, but just in case any listeners didn't pick that up, sorry for my dog barking there.
Oh,
yeah, a cat always sets her off at some point during my interviews. It's par for the course. But yes, was there anything about the VR nature of the game, the virtual reality nature of it, that you had to consider in your composing, or was it just a regular composing job?
It was, they didn't really specify anything that had to be unique about it, but because I am so familiar with VR, and since I have a VR system, I play a lot of games, you know, I pay attention, of course, to what I'm listening to. And the thing with VR, the only difference really in this case is that I knew people were going to be wearing headphones. You know, in a regular video game situation, you can wear headphones, or you can not wear headphones. You can have it coming out of your system or your TV or whatever. But in the case of VR, you're definitely wearing headphones. So the only, and, you know, they didn't really call that to my attention, but, I'm familiar with it. And so it just enabled me to have a little bit more fun with the left and right channels in the music. So, you know, anytime I had an opportunity to maybe, you know, play around and have something come on the left and sweep to the right, or all these little details that I could widen it and get out of the way of the center, so that I can allow the sound effects and the talking to be, you know, the guns and stuff, and I could put my music on the sides. I did that as well. But if you were to listen to it, you know, on a set of speakers, it sounds just as good. It just, there might be a little bit more action going on left and right. I had a little bit more fun with the panning that you'd never really appreciate or in a regular, you know, just listening on your television.
Absolutely. And you've been composing games for a long time now, and I've got a couple of questions actually about some of your older games that I'm a big fan of. But do you think that game audio is going to significantly change as VR becomes more involved with games?
Well, you know, when VR first came out, I think I was imagining there'd be a lot more unique needs when it came to music for VR. And although I do see different ways of that you can really take advantage of the immersive nature of VR games and the 3D proximity. At the end of the day, it's not really like a whole new way of approaching music. It doesn't have to be. You certainly can. You certainly can have a lot of fun by playing around with distance and, you know, locations and putting in a space that's linked to the environment. But in many cases, it just becomes a soundtrack that's playing in your head, you know, left and right, close, right there. Just like the emotion you want to create in anything, a horror game or any other kind of game. So in that sense, I would say, no, really, it wasn't unique musically in the way that I had to approach because it was a VR game.
Yeah, I think as a non-games composer myself, I think it's easy to imagine lots of different applications for audio. But then when you come to it in VR, it probably either doesn't work or feels weird or is difficult to achieve.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. You know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. But, you know, once in a while, something comes along where it really breaks the boundaries and it becomes very innovative. And I'm still looking for that kind of thing. I mean, I do really embrace that, especially it's like something that you can only do in VR. But so far in my limited time scoring VR games specifically, I haven't seen much of that on my own material and on other material that I've listened to in VR games.
There'll be a lot to come in the future. We'll have to see where it goes. But to reach back in the past a little bit, like I said, I'm actually a particularly big fan of Red Steel, or at least grew up playing it. So I couldn't not bring it on when speaking to you today.
Thank you. That's one of my favorites. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, funnily enough, weekly I do this little stream where, because I'm a bass player, I play bass over various video game music pieces each week. And I did a piece from Red Steel just a couple of weeks ago, actually.
Oh, wow. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I'll send you a link through. It was really cool. But I love that music. And it's actually really cool how it has this like electronic EDM kind of feel for Red Steel 1. But then in Red Steel 2, you kind of right. moved on to different things and... I'm interested in that different, yeah. those different projects and different styles, and how easy it might be for you to mold yourself into those different styles.
Right. Oh, yes. And that's such a great question. No one's ever asked me that before. Happy to discuss it. The Red Steel 1 was a very unique, specific game, and I enjoyed it so much because the musical styles from map to map, level to level, were so diverse, and it had such a unique personality to it, and I so much credit the audio director Manu on that. He's out of his mind, I think, sometimes. Like some of the ideas he came to me with are like, really, you want to do that? And we had so little time. I literally had to do like a map of music a day on that, less than a month, and it was really something. So it really forced me not to second guess, and you know, he would play me reference music. I'm like, really, we're gonna do that now? You know, we're gonna do like, you know, 1950s sci-fi meets horror meets circus music is like, okay, you know. And or and you know, that's just one level, and then we do another level, it's like, you know, J-pop, and do another level, it's like, you know, like 80s R&B sung by Japanese people, or, you know, like it was just so crazy. And then the choral stuff, you know, like Ghost in the Shell inspired, you know, choral music, and, you know, so that was Red Steel 1. It was a certain thing. Red Steel 2 was almost like a completely different game. It shared the name, but it was like completely different. So, you know, Red Steel 1 took place in Japan. And, you know, I was very true to the Japanese musical styles and culture. And, you know, I brought in, you know, authentic Japanese performers and singers. And you know, I wanted to be very respectful and accurate with it. And I had a lot of fun with that. With Red Steel 2, very different. So the recipe with that, it was like a Chinese Western. So it wasn't Japanese, it was a Chinese Western. So if you listen even to the scales themselves, they're pentatonic, but they're in the Chinese vocabulary and Chinese percussion. It wasn't Japanese. So it was like this high energy adrenaline Western music married with Chinese influences. So with Red Steel 2, it was a completely different approach. Instead of Japanese, it was a Chinese influenced score melded with the Wild West, but in a very aggressive way. So it had this distinct guitar tone, which was a huge credit to my collaborator, Steve Wamet, a masterful guitar god who really brought that home and delivered what was needed for that. And just as a player, he's just so and such a great player and a master of tone. But the only crossover was there was the original theme that we wanted to bring across, that choral melody. So we did kind of bring those same singers back from Red Steel 1 to give that very, I guess you'd say, old ancient Asian kind of choir sound blended into it. And I don't know, I've never really heard anything quite like that. It's such a unique blend. I'm sure there's something out there, but I haven't heard it yet. So it was really fun to kind of create that unique signature sound like I always try to do for all my projects. But Red Steel is very close to my heart, both 1 and 2.
Yeah, I mean, God, just thinking about those games as you were talking, it takes me right back to being about 14. I was a huge fan of Red Steel when it first came out on the Wii. And it blew my mind as well, using the Wiimote and everything for the gun.
Yeah, that was a release title. That came out right when the Wii was came out. So it was like that and Zelda and, you know, Mario, I think. And it was like, wow. So having the opportunity to be on the cutting edge of a brand new system was very exciting. Sure, there were some bugs. It was a little awkwardness and, you know, some criticisms about the control. But, man, I give them so much credit to try to break boundaries and do things that you hadn't done before. I mean, just, you know, using those controllers and throwing a grenade, like by throwing your hand and, you know, doing the sword fighting, switching from gun shooting to sword fighting. And, I mean, come on. That was amazing.
So cool. While we're on the subject of your old stuff, and another game that was similarly super, super cool and I was obsessed with, that again I feel like I have to bring up, is Crackdown, on which a few of your tracks as Atlas Plug are used. And I thought I could ask actually about the difference, or if there is necessarily a difference between Tom Salter and Atlas Plug, how you might approach those tracks.
yeah. So for anyone that doesn't know, Atlas Plug is my artist name. And that's really how I entered the industry in 2003. Because prior to that, I worked in the record business. I was a record producer, you know, songwriter, programmer for 15 years. And in 2001, that's really I kind of got the bug to transition more into a different area of music and start over in many ways. So in order to do that, being a nobody in the video game world, Atlas Plug was my crazy idea to come out with this artist name that would create music perfect for licensing in TV, films, and video games. And I got the sense that it would be more marketable to be an artist rather than just me, like Tom Salta. So that's why I kind of created this new moniker, this new personality, so I could kind of separate the Tom Salta person from the mystique of an artist. And there is a little bit of a difference. I mean, certainly, obviously, it's me. So, you know, I can, if I want to do Atlas Plug music, I can. But I wanted to kind of separate it into Atlas Plug is really about high octane electronica, you know, whatever, whether it's big beat or you know, modern, whatever is like cutting edge EDM, aggressive music, it falls under the Atlas Plug umbrella. And the only project since the original stuff I did back in 2003 and 4 that I returned to Atlas Plug was in Killer Instinct Season 3 that I did with Cell Dweller and aka Clayton. But yeah, so Crackdown was amazing. I was obsessed with that game. And Microsoft came and licensed pre-existing music from the Two Days or Die album, which is still out there. You can still, and it still holds up, I think, today, so many years later. You know, but it was so cool. There's a funny story with Crackdown. There were a bunch of games, certainly, that License Atlas plugged. The first one was Rally Sport Challenge 2. Crackdown, Project Gotham, a bunch of others, a lot of Microsoft titles. But what was unique about Crackdown, and I didn't know it until I was playing the game. So, of course, you play the game, you get into the car, and the music comes on, and sometimes it's an Atlas Plug track, and it comes up in the Chiron on the screen, Atlas Plug, you know, 2 days or die, or halfway to Bliss, or get rolled on, or whatever the track it is. And that was so cool. But then, as I'm playing around in the game in that first city, and I'm looking around climbing buildings and stuff, there are three places in that city where they actually, someone, one of the level designers, took it upon himself to scan the cover of my album and put it on the buildings on a big billboard. So if you play Crackdown, you see the cover of Atlas Plug 2 days or Die. It says Atlas Plug in fine stores everywhere. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you know, I'm calling my wife. I'm like, come here, look at this. You know, it's like I'm in the city. It's like I have this, you know, these three different billboards. It was like, you know, they didn't ask my permission, but did I care? Of course not. That's good. Advertise away. Thank you.
When I was obsessed with that game, again, I was quite young, going back to when I was 15 or something, and I wasn't thinking about game audio as much back then. But it, I definitely did get this sense that like the whole game had this own little world, and even the music was included in that. I remember thinking, what, where is this music come from? And it felt like it was from the world itself. And I mean, with these billboards, like I remember seeing it as a part of the world, and seeing these band names as well.
Well, yeah. And it's funny you should say that, because now that you mention it, there is one track that I did specifically for that game as Atlas Plug. So it was called Around the World. And it was what happened was Peter, he was the person at Microsoft who was dealing with my publisher to license music. He contacted them and me, and they said, can you create an EDM modern Asian inspired track to that we can use when you're going into the district? And I forgot the name of the district, but it was like the Asian Mafia, right? It was like the hardest one. It was the last one. We have to go over to this bridge. And so I'm like, oh, great. Awesome. So it enabled me to kind of create this one track, which ended up becoming a single. It's the only single beyond the original album right now, called Around the World. And so it was created for the game, and it was inspired by the game and the whole atmosphere of that, you know, the whole personality of the game. So and I'm glad that you said that it kind of fits in there. So thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you said you was obsessed with it yourself, because I was frighteningly obsessed with it when it first came out.
Oh, my God. And it's so satisfying to kind of level up in that game. You know, you start just as a sort of enhanced human, and then by the end of it, you're jumping across buildings, and you just feel like, you know, it's a superhero. It was amazing. And they have it. I'm so glad that it's now, it's returned, it's backwards compatible. So you if you still kept it, or you can find it for a few bucks, you can go ahead and play it again. It's just so satisfying. I love it.
Yeah, it's an absolute must play. But so my final question for today then would be, because I am actually doing an upcoming podcast, a special about racing games, and you have quite a few racing games under your belt, like you mentioned Project Gotham, Need for Speed, things like that. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about whether you feel racing games have their own specific style, and anything you might do unique to that genre.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to racing, I think just like it has a certain need, it has a certain personality, it has a certain dimension that you have to bring to it. And then, of course, a lot of it has to do with speed, right? So I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why Atlas Plug works so well in racing games, is because 9 out of 10 of those tracks, you can easily get a speeding ticket if you put that on in your car, because it's just like, boom, boom, da, 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 da. It's like, man, it's very driving. So it kind of gets the adrenaline going. It gives you the sense of speed and motion. And it was really because of that album that I got a call to work on Need for Speed Underground 2. That was original music just for Need for Speed. But Charles, the audio director in that one, he was, you know, heavily saying, no, I want this like Atlas Plug. I want this like Atlas Plug. I love Two Days or Die. Give me something just like that, you know? And, you know, so I guess it just had the certain vibe to it. I mean, the drums, you know, it's just like driving. It's like, yes. So I'd say, you know, when it comes to driving games or driving in real life, just that feeling of adrenaline and, I don't know, just whether it be rock music or electronica rock or whatever it is, it just seems to work really well, doesn't it?
And actually, a question that's occurred to me quickly is that some of your music as Atlas Plug has been licensed into games, but then, of course, you've written original soundtracks as well. And when it comes to games like racing games, they often will just have a massive list of licensed tracks from big famous pop bands. So how do you That's feel right. about that as somebody who has both been licensed and written original stuff?
Hey, I think it's great. I mean, if it works, it works. It's just like a movie. I mean, you know, in a good movie, there's often a balance between licensed, you know, songs and score. And at the end of the day, it's really about what works for the product, what supports it the best. I mean, if you could do an entire game and it just sounds awesome with licensed, you know, songs, great, go for it. So, you know, I'm not going to be... I'm not speaking as a composer, you know, I'm like, you know, as a composer, you would say, well, no, it should be all original. And, you know, no, I mean, I see it from all sides. I think it's really about the art. So if it licenses away, some people would get really creative with that. I remember there was one project that I was going to be working on where the whole idea was they would take licensed music, but they'd get the stems. Meaning they get the submixes of, let's say, just the drums, just the guitars, just the bass, and it allowed them to not only control it, make it more dynamic for the game, but it also allowed some overscore, some additional scoring or on top of it to make it, let's say, more hybrid, for example, or to enhance it so it felt a little bit more epic or, you know, movie trailer-esque. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's a fusion. So music is music, whether it's written prior, after, to, independently of, who cares, you know? It's all music and it's all art.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you very much for appearing, Tom. This has been an absolutely wonderful interview.
Oh, great. Thanks so much, Lee. It was great talking to you.
Well, before you go, of course, I want to ask about anything you might be up to at the moment and what you've got on your plate right now.
Oh, sure. You know, there's a few things on my plate, but one of them that kind of ties into what we talked about today, which is 80s-centric, is I actually started a little fun side project with my brother-in-law, which is a podcast about growing up in the 80s. It's called Two Guys and the 80s, and it's just a fun thing that we release every month, and we just talk about growing up in the 80s. We talk about music and video games and movies, TV shows, food, everything, and it's hilarious. We edit in music and sound effects, and we talk, and it's really fun. It just brings me back. It's really nostalgic, and it's kind of like a feel-good thing, and we have a lot of fun. So any of your listeners out there who loves the 80s, that's also they might want to check it out, but thanks.
Yeah, myself and my listeners, I think we're all pretty gigantic pop culture enthusiasts, so that's up all of our streets, I think.
Awesome.
All right, so Tom, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Great. No, thank you, Lee. Anytime, I'd love to talk to you again.
Thanks to Tom for speaking to me for the Sound Zest. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, you can hear more of my interviews, both as documentary podcasts or casual chats like this, on whatever platform you're listening on. You can find out more about Tom's work through tomsalter.com or follow him on Twitter, where he's at tomsalter. Additionally, you can find some links to his Wolfenstein music in the description. Finally, thank you for listening, and don't forget to like and subscribe to show your support and stay up to date with my output.